Morning, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize to you for the delay. The delay had nothing to do with this case. Essentially, in two other, I told you I have about 550 other cases. And on two of those cases, some crises arose over the weekend. They had to see them immediately, and I had to deal with it. I apologize. I don't like to keep you waiting. The attorneys and I met together on Friday, and we, as I told you, in every case, there are matters that we have to take up outside your presence. And we got those things accomplished. And then also the attorneys spent a great deal of time, and they came up with a proposed trial schedule to cover. We're already half hour behind the schedule, but that's my fault. To come up with a comprehensive schedule. They both say they're going to stick to the schedule, so they have certain numbers of hours allotted for each witness, and they'll stick to the schedule. It's very tight. It gets the case completed on Wednesday, July 3rd. The only real question is we'll decide if we want to start deliberations that day and if we want to have deliberations on Friday after July 4th. And that'll be up to you, I think, because although I have the impression some of you already have plans for that day, but so probably we'll stick to this schedule and you may end up coming back the weekend after the July 4th, the Monday after the July 4th weekend, to do your deliberations, the way it looks to me. Does anybody have plans for July 5th at this time? So probably we'll not, and then we'll have to decide if we want to begin deliberations before, or I might save, let you go. If we stick to this schedule, we'll be letting you go a little early on July 3rd, which is a Wednesday, and then telling you to come back Monday, July 7th, to begin deliberations. So who is the next witness? Are we going to resume the testimony of Dr. Zarnik at this time?
We're going to resume cross-examination.
Okay, Dr. Zarnik, you still are under oath. Anthony Zarnik, having been previously duly sworn, resumed the witness stand and testified further as follows.
Good morning, Dr. Zarnik.
Good morning, ma'am.
Now, on your direct testimony, you told us that in connection with the ABI deal, Illumina agreed to deliver to ABI these arrays. Is that correct?
Yes.
So chemistry contributed, right?
Yes.
And molecular biology contributed?
Yes.
And engineering as well?
Yes.
Isn't it true that you understood at the time that the application for which ABI was going to use this array was a genotyping application?
Their initial interest was in the genotyping application.
Well, their initial interest is what was covered by the deal that was struck by Illumina and ABI, correct?
Yes.
Let's put up Exhibit 21. Dr. Zarnik, this Exhibit 21 is an exhibit we've previously seen. It is your letter to Dr. Stulpnagel expressing an interest in coming to work for Illumina and indicating the terms upon which you would be willing to go to work for Illumina. Is that right?
Yes.
And did you make... So this was one of the early written communications between you and Dr. John Stulpnagel relating to the terms under which you were willing to come to Illumina, correct?
Yes.
Directing your attention to this portion in which you were talking about a salary for your wife, did you make any misrepresentations or false statements in this letter?
No.
What about this statement, where it says you're proposing that the company pay a portion of a salary to your wife for her editorial assistance, and you say in this letter that this represents a one-third company contribution and a continuation of the circumstance under which REC's compensation exists today. Do you see that?
Yes.
That was not an accurate statement, was it?
It was an accurate statement.
Isn't it true, Dr. Zarnik, that at the time you wrote this solicitation letter, which was April 3rd, you were employed by Irori?
Yes.
And isn't it true that Irori never paid your wife any salary?
Yes, that's true.
Well, then, how can you reconcile, Dr. Zarnik, your statement that a one-third company contribution and two-thirds ACS contribution was what was then in place at the time you wrote this letter?
At that time, two-thirds of Becky's salary was being paid by the ACS. So that was $30,000 a year. And that's all the statement says, that Becky was receiving $30,000 a year from the ACS.
Well, no. Doesn't this statement say more than that? Doesn't this say that this represents a one-third company contribution, two-thirds of which is provided by the ACS, and the proposed arrangement is a continuation of the circumstance under which REC's compensation exists today.
I see that, but it doesn't imply what I think you are trying to imply. I mean, the company, with a capital C there, was referring to Illumina. And certainly Illumina wasn't making a one-third contribution to Becky's salary.
Okay, so what you are telling us is that this modifier, a continuation of the circumstance under which REC's compensation exists today, you are telling us that that language only applies to the two-thirds which was being provided by the ACS?
No, what I meant to imply is that a third of Becky's salary would be paid by a second source, two-thirds by the ACS. And at that time, the one-third was... essentially, Becky just wasn't receiving it.
But wouldn't you agree with me that this letter could easily be read to suggest that you were telling John Stulpnagel that the current arrangement, the circumstances under which REC's compensation exists today, involved a one-third payment by your company and two-thirds by ACS?
I suppose it might be read that way.
In fact, didn't you put that language in the letter knowing that Becky was not receiving any money from Irori, merely in an effort to try to negotiate hard and to get Illumina to pay part of her salary?
I certainly had hoped Illumina would pay a part of her salary. In academic settings, the secretaries of editors are supplemented by the academic institution, so I was certain we would have the same relationship with Illumina.
Dr. Zarnik, you weren't under a misimpression in coming to Illumina. You were joining an academic institution, were you?
No, I've done my time in academics.
You understood Illumina was an industrial company and not an academic university.
I'm a founder. I realize that.
Now let's focus for a moment on the lunch that you believed that you initiated with Jay Flatley, either in October 1999 or November of 1999. On direct, you said that you had scheduled this lunch with Mr. Flatley because he had come on board and he had not even tried to sit down and meet with you, correct?
Well, for the 3 weeks that Jay was there, we had had no substantial discussions, as I would have expected for a CEO.
And isn't it true that Jay Flatley had a 45-minute substantial discussion with you even before he started, even before he was formally on board at Illumina?
If the email is accurate, then it looks like we did have a 45-minute discussion.
And if you remember that email from last week, it appears he had similar 45-minute meetings with the other senior managers as well, correct?
Yes.
Now, it is during this particular lunch in which you have attributed some statement to Jay Flatley, which caused you to conclude right then and there that he had some information about your disability, right?
Yes.
Now, isn't it true that during this lunch on your direct, you said that what you told Jay Flatley was that you could be cynical at times, but that you were able to control it?
Yes.
And what is it that Mr. Flatley said in response?
Jay's response was, "Are you sure it isn't more than that?"
And from that question posed by Mr. Flatley, you concluded from his words that he knew that you had a medical condition?
That, in addition to the follow-up statement, which was, you know, how will I know when you're feeling that way?
The term depression wasn't used by either of you during this conversation?
That's correct.
The term medical condition wasn't used by either of you during this discussion?
That's correct.
Is it your contention that most people would interpret the words cynical to mean depressed or afflicted with a medical condition?
Objection. Calls for speculation.
Overruled.
Well, that statement, coupled with my follow-up, which was, this isn't something that I really want to discuss right now, and then also having had a lot of experience with this, I've learned to gauge myself. I think that you would at least be on heightened alert that this person was aware of some aspect of your medical condition that you'd hope they wouldn't be.
So have you now testified, both in your direct and just this moment, have you now testified to everything it is that Jay Flatley did or said during this lunch meeting that caused you to reach the conclusion that he had some information about your medical condition?
Yes.
Now, you have no reason. In fact, you understand that Jay Flatley is not a medical doctor, correct?
Yes.
And you understand that Jay Flatley is not a trained psychiatrist or psychologist, correct?
Yes.
And nonetheless, It's your contention that you think that from the conversation you recounted to us, he clearly, in your mind, knew that you had a medical condition?
Clearly, meaning high likelihood. And I certainly left that conversation feeling that Jay wanted to have a discussion with me about my medical condition, but since I had cut it off, we weren't going to have that discussion.
Well, when you say we had cut it off, you cut it off, right?
Yes, I did cut it off.
Why didn't you interpret his question to mean that he was inquiring, how will I know when you are in a cynical frame of mind? I'm just trying to explore why you didn't adopt that interpretation of his statement.
Well, when Jay made the statement, are you sure it isn't more than that? Frankly, that was sufficient for me to understand that he knew it was more than that.
And what is your definition or your understanding of the meaning of the word cynical?
It means you don't always take things at face value. That sometimes things happen for reasons other people don't really want you to understand. And a cynical person will recognize that and recognize that they are not being told the whole story.
And you felt that by using the word cynical with Mr. Flatley, you were tipping your hand that you had depression?
No, it was not at all my intent to tip my hand that I had depression. I simply wanted Jay to be aware that it was possible for my mood to swing, so that if he did notice a mood swing, he wouldn't be concerned about it. I was in no way trying to telegraph to Jay that I had depression.
Why didn't you say, from time to time I have mood swings, but I've learned to control them?
Frankly, I think being cynical is more socially acceptable than having mood swings.
And so you will agree with me, will you not, that cynical does have a meaning which is different from depressed?
Yes.
Do you consider yourself to be a cynical person?
I'd say under my definition, sometimes I can be cynical.
Let me move now to the February 2000 breakfast that you had with David Walt. This is a breakfast which he initiated?
Yes.
And during this breakfast, he asked you whether you were still interested in Illumina, correct?
Correct.
Did he express any concerns or worries about your preparation of or your conduct of the SAB meeting which had just occurred?
No, David did not.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Now, isn't it true, Dr. Zarnik, that the Illumina SAB was not your first experience with a scientific advisory board?
To my recollection, it was my first experience with a scientific advisory board.
So you seem to be having trouble recalling. Let me see if I can refresh your memory. Isn't it true that at the time you were negotiating to join Illumina, you were a member of the scientific advisory board of Sensors in Medicine, which is in fact today your current employer?
Yes, that's correct.
And in fact, as a condition of joining Illumina, Illumina said you would need to step down from Sensors SAB because of potential conflict of interest?
Yes, that's correct. I was on the SAB at Sensors, although we never met.
But strictly in response to my question then, you had been on an SAB before you joined Illumina?
Yes.
Now, during your direct examination in connection with discussion about the January 2000 SAB meeting, there had been some discussion about the timing and the content of the agenda which you prepared. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And on your direct examination, you testified that you had prepared an agenda for this January meeting, correct?
Yes.
And that you shared it with John and Mark?
Yes.
And that they basically told you to change it?
Yes.
Let's put 115 up. So on direct, when you were talking to us about your preparation of an agenda, you testified that Drs. Chi and Stulpnagel were emphatic that you not have as an agenda item discussion of technical problems.
Yes.
At this point in time, Dr. Zarnik, January of 2000, you were still the chief scientific officer, weren't you?
Yes.
You didn't report to John Stulpnagel, correct?
No.
And you didn't report to Mark Chi either, did you?
No.
In fact, you reported to Jay Flatley?
Yes.
And you didn't share your initial draft of the agenda with Jay Flatley, did you?
No, I didn't.
And let's blow this up one more time if we can. On Tuesday, January 18, Jay Flatley was emailing you and asking whether you had an agenda for the SAB meeting, which was 3 days later, correct?
Yes.
And your response, so that same evening, you tell Mr. Flatley, not yet, that you did not have an agenda yet. and you go on to discuss what you were intending. Much of the meeting will be people at Illumina setting up their problem, posing it, being present to hear the discussion, etc. You see that language?
Yes.
Mr. Flatley never came to you and discouraged you from including on your agenda the content of this email, did he?
No, he didn't.
And so you had, by Tuesday, January 18th, you had told Jay Flatley, although you haven't produced an agenda, you'd summarized for him part of what you intended to include in the agenda, right?
Yes.
He didn't object to it?
No, he didn't.
And you delivered an agenda to him two nights later, Thursday night, the night before the SAB, correct?
Correct.
And you did not include in that agenda the content that you wanted to include about having R&D people talk about their specific problems.
That's correct.
Is it your testimony that the reason you didn't include that topic is because John Stulpnagel and Mark Chi had expressed disagreement with it?
Yes.
And this is notwithstanding the fact that you reported to Jay Flatley, and it was Jay Flatley to whom you owed the agenda?
Yes.
Dr. Zarnik, let me now focus for a moment on the Daly's dinner, February 7th, 2000. You told Jay Flatley during this dinner that your offer to step down as CSO was still good, correct?
Yes.
And upon questioning by Mr. Flatley, you said that it wasn't critical to you that you remain in a management role, right?
Correct.
Now, you told Mr. Flatley that you wanted to participate or even take the lead in identifying a new CSO, correct?
Yes.
And will you agree with me, though, that Jay Flatley was under no obligation to allow you to do so?
Yeah, Jay had no formal obligation to allow me to do that.
So if he wanted to choose his own CSO without your input at all, that was within his right to do so?
Yes.
Do you think David Barker is qualified to be Illumina's CSO?
Based on what I know of David from interacting with him for a couple of months, yes.
Well, and in connection with David Barker's joining Illumina, you had an opportunity to see his CV and so forth, correct?
Yes.
You've seen it in the course of this litigation as well?
Yes.
So apart from interacting with him for just a couple of months, you also do have some information about his scientific training and background?
Actually, I hadn't seen David's CV until this litigation.
But you now have information about his training and background?
Yes.
Do you respect David Barker scientifically?
Yes. David doesn't push the right way to do experiments in the same way that I tend to push it, but I think that David is a fair guy who knows the area and he respects scientists.
Now, were you... One of the issues that you've made out in this case is you do seem to have some resentment over not having been involved in selecting the new CSO. Is that accurate?
I really wish I'd been allowed to be involved in the selection. That's true.
Isn't that because you wanted to get a bonus for finding your replacement?
No.
Isn't that what you meant when you say you wanted to follow in John Stulpnagel's shoes?
No, I just wanted to be valued.
Well, how do you believe that John Stulpnagel's finding his replacement was valued, and how was that value manifested?
As John mentioned in his testimony, in this world of startups, it's very common for the initial founder, the CEO, to be involved with the company for 2 years or 3 years. And then once the company needs to start commercializing something, for the venture group to come in and say, "You're not the right guy to be CEO any longer, we need a new person." And in a large percentage of the cases, there's a big fight and the board has to physically remove the original guy. So when John offered to step back, it was something that was valued by the board, but they didn't have to go through this standard fight.
Well, you too had offered to step back, so there's a parallel there. Both you and John Stulpnagel both voluntarily stepped down from your positions, right?
Yes.
So don't you think that the board valued that on your part?
Apparently not.
Because you didn't get a bonus, right?
Because my stock was cut so much.
Well, the stock had something to do... Your stock actually wasn't cut while you were at Illumina, correct?
You're right. Ultimately, because it was illegal for them to do it without my permission.
Well, Dr. Zarnik, just so that there's no confusion on the jury's part, you say because my stock was cut so much. Isn't it true that Jay Flatley told you he intended to reduce the amount of stock in which you would vest because you were taking a lower level position than CSO and because you would no longer have any managerial duties? He told you he intended to, correct?
Jay told me he intended to, yes.
And he then, in fact, I think you testified that you were in the room, had a conversation with counsel, not me, but a prior law firm, in which he was told that the stock vesting could be changed only if you agreed to it, right?
I wasn't in the room when that conversation occurred, but I learned of the conversation later.
Okay. And Jay Flatley did present you with a change in position agreement and asked you to sign it, correct? He asked you to sign it?
Yeah, a bit like Simon Legree asked Nell to vacate her house.
You declined to sign it?
Yes, I did.
Your stock?
Yes, I did.
And your stock was never reduced while you were at Illumina?
No, it was not.
Okay. Now, I think from your direct testimony, it seems to be your position that it was March 1st, 2000, when Jay Flatley told you he was taking you up on your offer to step down as CSO, correct?
Yes.
And at some time shortly after that, you became aware that the company and its outside lawyers were preparing the S-1 registration statement for the IPO, correct?
Yes.
And you say that you asked to participate?
Yes.
Now, you didn't have any prior experience in drafting or preparing an S-1, did you?
No.
The drafting and preparation of an S-1, for the most part, is not a scientific activity, correct?
It involves an important description of the company's science technology. So there's a lot of it that isn't scientific, but there's a very important part that is.
And you had never before been involved in drafting a description of any company's scientific activities for use in an S-1?
That's correct.
Now, did you understand at the time that Jay Flatley had taken a company public before and had experience in the S-1 drafting process?
Yes.
And did you understand that David Barker also had that same experience?
Yes.
And did you understand that on a going-forward basis, David Barker was going to be the company's CSO?
Yes.
Now, you took issue with not being included in an early draft in the section that is entitled Executive Management and Directors, right?
Yes.
Now, at the time, you were not a director, true? You've never been a director.
I've never been a director with the board.
And as of March 1st, whether it was documented in your personnel file yet or not, but as of March 1st, you had been told that you would be stepping down from an executive management role and would be becoming a research fellow, correct?
Yes, Jay did tell me that on March 1st.
So you had no reason to believe that on a going forward basis, you would be a member of executive management?
I was not a member of executive management.
So you are saying, actually, as of the date Jay communicated to you, you no longer considered yourself part of executive management?
As of that date, I wasn't part of management.
And the research fellow position itself is not a management position, right?
Generally, yes. And as it was used at Illumina, yes.
I believe you told us on direct that you insisted and you were eventually included in the final version of the S-1 in that same section, correct?
Yes.
And that's even though you weren't a member of executive management, right?
Yes.
And you weren't a director, correct?
Yes.
And you insisted upon being included there, even though you filled neither of those roles, because you wanted the public recognition, correct?
I insisted on being recognized as a founder. I actually had suggested that a good place to put it might be in the SAB section. It didn't really matter to me where it occurred, but it was important to me it did occur that I was listed as a founder.
Were you, as of the point in time when you were no longer CSO, were you a member of the SAB?
No, that was a part of the negotiations that we had had that I might join the SAB.
So in a document which you understood was going to be filed with the SEC, you were proposing that they represent you to be a member of the SAB, even though that was not accurate at the time.
What I was proposing was that I be made a member of the SAB and then added to the document.
Do you have any knowledge or training in the content of an S-1 registration statement?
I certainly have knowledge of the science and technical parts of the S-1 that was filed.
But do you know, one way or another, who dictates the content that must be included in an S-1? In other words, do you know for a fact whether Illumina decides what information goes in or whether the SEC dictates the information that must be included?
I think the SEC dictates the content based on laws of 1933 and 1934.
Now, isn't it true that as a consequence of your insistence that you be listed in the S-1, this meant that your Illumina stock was locked up for a longer period than it would have been had you not been listed?
If that's true, I didn't know it until you took my deposition.
So you don't remember having discussions with John Stulpnagel in which he described to you the consequence of being listed in the S-1?
On my honor, we did not have that discussion.
Okay. Another statement you made during direct is that you weren't invited to be on the trading floor of NASDAQ on the date of the IPO. Is that correct?
I believe I made that statement.
That statement is incorrect, right? Well, I guess it's a correct statement. You weren't invited to be on the trading floor of the NASDAQ. But in fact, you now know today that the Illumina Roadshow team was not on the floor of NASDAQ on the opening day, correct?
I've subsequently learned that they weren't on the trading floor. During the time of the roadshow, there was some thought that there was going to be an interview with Jay on the floor of NASDAQ on the opening day. So we were actually quite excited about that back at the company. Apparently, that didn't come through.
Because you had some information that there might be an interview with Jay Flatley on the floor of NASDAQ, you assumed that the team would be on the floor of NASDAQ, correct?
Well, that was a pretty reasonable assumption, I think.
Well, whether you think it was reasonable or not, you made the assumption, correct?
Yes.
And you subsequently learned that the team actually was on the trading floor at Goldman Sachs Investment Brokerage rather than at NASDAQ, correct?
That's what I've been told, yes.
So your direct testimony about people being on the floor of NASDAQ was a little imprecise, correct?
It was apparently incorrect.
Now, another area I'd like to discuss with you, Dr. Zarnik, very briefly. You testified toward the end of your direct examination. Your marriage has been affected by your dispute with Illumina, correct?
Yes.
Isn't it true your intimate relationship with your wife has been impaired or affected for roughly the last 10 years?
I'm going to object. We are not making any sort of loss of consortium claim or seeking any damages relating to any alleged loss of consortium.
Well,
there was a claim made in his testimony that doesn't necessarily relate to damages. Just he testified to that doesn't necessarily relate to damages. Just he testified to.
I don't mind answering this question. It's an unfortunate side effect of virtually all the antidepressant medications to have loss of libido. And in part for that reason, I tried to take myself off of it a couple of times, and each time has crashed. So I get to make this choice between being depressed or intimate with my wife. I made the decision not to be depressed, or my wife and I made it together.
My point is this impairment in your intimate relationship is something which, first of all, existed long before you came to Illumina, correct?
Bob Dole calls it erectile dysfunction.
If you want me to go there, I'll just say your impotence issue pre-existed coming to Illumina. You're not saying Illumina caused the sexual problems.
No.
It's the medication?
It's the medication.
And you'd been on the medication since roughly 1992?
Yes.
So your testimony on direct, when you said your marriage has been harmed by the events that occurred at Illumina, you said that, right?
Yes.
But in deposition, you said that you wouldn't be taking that position. Isn't that true?
I take the positions in the case, and I said then, as I said now, we are not seeking. There's no loss of consortium claim here.
I think you ought to not characterize what's in the deposition. And you made a particular page reference, and
I'll just read from the deposition.
Give counsel a chance to object if he wants to.
Because there was a statement that certain things would not be claimed, and I think the plaintiff has made a claim.
I'll sustain the objection to that. I think in that it's confusing as to what that means. So I'll sustain the objection under 352.
Your Honor, I think it's... If we can see, Your Honor, I think...
What page and line are we talking about?
We are talking about page 927, line 24, through page 928. 928, 11.
924 is the page?
No, 927, line 24.
What volume is that?
It's the last volume, volume 6.
I don't know if I have that volume. Do you have an objection to that, counsel?
I do, Judge.
Your Honor, I would say the deposition passage, which I'm happy to approach and let you take a look at.
Yes.
Your Honor, I'm offering it not to dwell on the intimacy issue, but there was a statement on direct by the plaintiff that he wasn't sure his marriage was going to survive this, and there's testimony on that issue in the passage.
Again, Your Honor, we're not making that claim.
This goes to more than loss of consortium.
Theoretically, can't she read from a deposition of the plaintiff without—
Not if it's irrelevant to the case, but—
I think it's relevant because on direct, the plaintiff testified, my marriage has been harmed. I'm not sure it's going to survive this.
He didn't say that on direct. He did not say that on direct.
Objections overruled.
Reading from your deposition, Dr. Zarnik, taken September 25th, 2001. Just so that I'm clear, it was my understanding that you're not making any— You are not making a contention that any issues in your marriage are attributable solely to what happened at Illumina, correct?
Correct.
And you've agreed with me that your sexual problems in your marriage predated the April 1999 meeting.
That's correct.
And I just want to make sure that you are not going to be contending at trial if your marriage has split up by then, by that point, that it was all due to what happened at Illumina.
Even if that's the case, I'm not going to contend it.
I'll reiterate, Judge, that I'm not going to contend it either.
In fact, I was chastised because I don't get to make contentions.
Let's move to another topic. Let's talk about decoding. Isn't it true, in connection with the decoding experiments that were being done at Illumina while you were there, chemistry had the responsibility or the task of delivering to molecular biology an array of beads which had DNA oligos attached to the beads?
That was our major responsibility.
And then the actual decoding of the DNA that was on the beads was something that was done primarily by molecular biology?
There's an additional step. What you said is correct. The decoding was typically done by molecular biology. But the synthesis of the decoder oligos changed with time. Originally, the company bought them, then chemistry made them, and then beginning in January of 2000, molecular biology took responsibility for that.
Okay. Now, you would agree with me that there is a difference between an experiment where the objective is to prove proof of principle or proof of concept and an experiment which is intended to definitively decode a certain number of beads, correct?
Gosh, that's a hard question.
Well, let me ask you a new question then. In your deposition, we went through at some length the decoding experiments, and you and I talked at some length about the concept of an experiment whose objective is feasibility or proof of principle. And I understood from your testimony that proof of principle or feasibility means can we do an experiment and draw reasonable conclusions that at this level of complexity, it works. It may not work perfectly, but that at this level of complexity, it is working.
Yeah, the intent of a proof of concept experiment is typically to say, should we be investing money in this further? Let's do an experiment that's close to the one we want to do ultimately. If it works, then we'll put the money into it. If it doesn't work, we'll rethink it.
But you would agree with me, wouldn't you, that a proof of principle or proof of concept or feasibility experiment doesn't have to work perfectly in order to draw a conclusion that it merits further research?
Yes, that's correct.
Or further repetition of the experiment?
That's correct.
Now, you did not personally conduct any of the work in the decoding experiments, did you?
No, I've been relieved of that as of January 2000.
Well, we've heard testimony about some prior decoding experiments. There was a series of 16-bead experiments?
Yes.
Did you personally do any of the experiments that were part of the 16-bead decode series?
If you mean with my own hands, no.
Yeah, I do.
No.
Did you personally do any of the experiments that were part of the 16-bead decode series?
No.
And you did not personally. Did you personally conduct any of the experiments that formed part of the 768 decode series?
As a member of management, we typically were not working in the lab.
Okay. And if, I don't know whether there was or not, but if there was a series of 256, you wouldn't have personally done any of those experiments either, correct?
There wasn't, and I didn't.
Okay. Now, one of the steps in the experiments is bead assembly, correct?
Yes.
bead assembly is the seating of the beads into the wells, right?
Yes.
And last week we had our exhibit, and so at the end of each fiber optic fiber, there's a little hole or a little pit. And into each one of those pits, ideally, you will have a bead, correct?
It's a lot like a Chinese checkerboard with the marbles, except the whole thing is much, much smaller.
Yes, much, much smaller. And there are at least a couple. In your deposition, we were talking about bead assembly, and you acknowledged to me there were at least a couple of different methods by which you could get the beads to seat and attach in the wells, correct?
Yes.
And you admitted in deposition that you didn't know which one of those methods was used in the 768 Decode experiment.
Objection. Form of the question, Judge.
Sustained.
You don't know what form or what method of bead assembly was used in the 768 Decode experiment, do you?
I don't know.
And isn't it true that there is a potential step that can be done in these Decode experiments called a stringency wash?
Yes.
And in lay terms, isn't it true that stringency wash is an extra step to make sure that you've washed away the complementary oligos?
Ones that don't bind tightly, yes.
And you don't know one way or another whether a stringency wash was used in the 768 Decode experiments?
That's correct.
And you would agree with me, would you not, that in order to call the 768 Decode experiment a success, it was not required that we actually decode each and every one of the 768 bead types.
That's correct.
Now, you said that the flaw in the 768 decode experiment was this mislabeled dye, right?
Well, the flaw was in the methodology. The dye just brought to the surface that the methodology was flawed.
The methodology meaning the dye wasn't tested before using it?
No, that the decode was so bad that even if a bad dye had been used, the scientists didn't notice it.
Well, wouldn't you agree that if the dye was tested before using it to make sure it is what the label says it is, that would have enabled the experimenters to determine the dye was what it purported to be?
Yes.
And in your deposition, or on your direct exam, I'm sorry, you said you had been advocating for testing. Quality control testing of dyes, beginning with the earliest decoding experiment, right?
Yes.
And the earliest decoding experiments, like the 16-bead experiment and the 128-bead experiment, those occurred while you were chief scientific officer, right?
Yes.
And you told us on direct that the tests to quality control or quality check the dyes would take either 5 minutes for a quick and dirty or 1 day for a more comprehensive test, right?
Yes.
And isn't it true, Dr. Zarnik, that as CSO, Chief Scientific Officer of the company, you had the tools, materials, and instrumentalities necessary to do these quality check tests?
Yes.
And isn't it true that as Chief Scientific Officer, you didn't have any limit on your spending authority?
No, I did have a limit, a $10,000 limit.
Are you suggesting that these tests would have cost $10,000?
No, not at all.
They would have been quite inexpensive, right?
Yes.
You had all the tools and materials available to you to do these tests, right?
Yes.
And you didn't do them, did you?
I didn't personally do them, no.
You didn't direct that they be done?
I tried to direct Mark to do it, but Mark can be very stubborn.
You were a chief scientific officer who had supervisory control over a number of people on your team, correct?
Yes.
And you didn't ask any of your scientists, like Steve Barnard or Todd Dickinson or Chanfeng Zhao, you didn't say to any of them, hey, I'd like you to spend 5 minutes and quality check this dye, did you?
No, they weren't using the dye.
Well, would they have been competent to test the dye had you instructed them to do so?
Yes.
And you didn't ask any of the people who are on your team to conduct this 5-minute quality control test of the dyes, correct?
No.
Let's see Exhibit 249. On suggestion of counsel, we'd suggest to take a short morning break.
We'll take our morning recess at this time. We'll be in recess until 10:45. Please remember the admonition not to form or express any opinion about the case, not to discuss the case. We'll be in recess until 10:45. 10:45. Theoretically, you have 40 minutes left.
I'll bring it in within that.
Then was there something you wanted to take up?
Right at this point?
Yes.
No.
Great. The record will indicate all the jurors present, counsel, and the parties present. You may continue your cross-examination.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Zarnik, I'd like to now focus on the concerns that you claimed to have raised concerning the 768 decoding experiment. Now, you told us that you believed that the 768 decode experiment was being done specifically to generate data for the roadshow?
That was one of the main purposes of doing that experiment.
And in deposition, you testified that it was common knowledge among the scientists
that— Object to the form of the question?
That the experiment was being done to generate data.
Sustained.
Did you believe that it was common knowledge among the scientists that the 768 decode experiment was done to generate data for the roadshow?
Yes.
In fact, were you the person who was telling scientists that the 768 decode experiment was meant to generate data for the roadshow?
Absolutely not.
But you are saying this was clearly common knowledge among the scientists?
We refer to it as the roadshow experiment.
When you say we, can you identify any of the other people who referred to this experiment as the roadshow experiment?
The people who I remember were Steve Barnard and Jim Beerley. Those are specific recollections, but this was absolutely common parlance.
Okay. But you have specific recollections of Steve Barnard and Jim Beerley referring to the 768 experiment as the roadshow experiment?
Yes.
What do you remember Steve Barnard saying? What conversation do you recall in which Steve Barnard called it the roadshow experiment?
It was a discussion in which we were talking about how hard it was going to be to do 768 decodes. I'm afraid I don't remember where we were standing or what time of day.
Do you recall when it was?
In a general sense, it was in the sort of April to May timeframe of 2000.
And what verbiage did Steve Barnard use in which he called the experiment the roadshow experiment?
Well, it was something as simple as, doing what we need to do for the roadshow experiment is going to be very difficult.
Are you aware of any written document that refers to this 768 decoding experiment as the roadshow experiment?
Just one email between Mark Chi and I.
In which you categorized it as the roadshow experiment.
And then Mark said he understood what I meant by that.
Is that your code blue email?
Yes.
We'll take a look at that momentarily. What do you remember Jim Beerley saying during which he referred to the 768 experiment as the roadshow experiment?
Again, something as simple as, you know, the whole decoding team is spending all of their time right now working on the roadshow experiment.
Do you remember when that conversation took place?
That was probably in June of 2000.
Why are you able to distinguish that conversation as having occurred later than the one that you had with Steve Barnard?
Because the one I had with Jim Beerley occurred after the first attempt failed.
Now, you believed at the time that the data was actually shown during the roadshow presentations?
I certainly have a belief that it was. It was created for use on the roadshow.
Are you saying that even today you have a belief that it was?
I believe it was created for use on the roadshow. I can't tell you whether it was or not.
Okay, just so that we've got some clarity, my question is whether or not you have a belief that data from the 768 experiment was actually shown on the roadshow?
The only data I have to the contrary is what John and Jay have testified to, and to the extent that I have concerns with their credibility on this issue, then I'm concerned that it may well have been.
Okay, let me ask you this. Do you have any information that would corroborate or support the idea that data regarding the 768 experiment was shown on the roadshow?
No, that would have required going out and questioning potential investors who were at these shows. And frankly, I haven't wanted to do that to the company.
Well, once we were in litigation after you sued the company...
Yes.
You understood that there's this discovery process, correct?
Yes.
And so you... It's an accurate statement that in the discovery process, neither you nor your counsel talked to any of the investors who heard the roadshow presentations, correct?
I'll object to the extent it may violate the attorney-client privilege.
I'm not asking for any communications. I'm asking whether, to his knowledge...
And work product, Judge. I'll object to the whole line of questioning on the grounds of relevance. As I said in my opening, we're not going to be able to present evidence in this trial it was actually used.
I think the question is objectionable. You might be able to rephrase the question.
Dr. Zarnik, you state that the only evidence that you have that data wasn't shown on the roadshow is the testimony of Jay Flatley and John Stulpnagel, and you made a gratuitous comment questioning their credibility or veracity. Do you have any information that supports a belief that data was actually shown on the roadshow relating to the 768 decode experiment?
Object to the form of the question. It's argumentative as phrased.
Overruled.
As I said, getting that data would have required interviewing investors, and I didn't want to do that to the company.
That's not my question. My question is whether you have any information, not how you would go about getting it. Do you have any information that supports a contention that data from the 768 was actually shown or discussed on the roadshow?
No.
Thank you. Now, you weren't on the roadshow, correct?
That's correct.
And during the roadshow, it was late in the roadshow, but it was toward the end of July that you learned from Monica Malewski that there was this problem with some of the dye that had been used, correct?
Yes.
And you didn't telephone any of the people who were on the roadshow to express any concern about the use of this data, did you?
No, I didn't have the schedule or phone number.
You knew that Jay Flatley had an executive assistant by the name of Carmela Haskell, didn't you?
Yes.
You didn't go to Carmela Haskell and say, I need you to get in touch with Jay, may I have the number? Correct? You didn't do that?
I didn't talk with Carmela, no.
And you knew that Carmela would have the roadshow schedule and would be able to track down Jay Flatley if need be.
I knew that Mark had that schedule, and Mark was head of the company on site. He was the right person to give this information to, not Carmela.
Well, you didn't go to Mark Chi and ask him for the schedule, did you?
No, it was appropriate for Mark to call Jay and to tell him about it.
Dr. Zarnik, I'm going to move to strike the "it was appropriate" comment.
Motion to strike granted, jury to disregard.
I'm just asking what you did. More pointedly, what you didn't do. You didn't ask anyone at the company for the roadshow schedule, correct?
That's correct.
You didn't ask anyone at the company to give you the phone number where the roadshow team could be reached, correct?
That's correct.
You didn't email anyone on the roadshow expressing any concern about the data from the 768 decode experiment, correct?
That's correct.
And in fact, you were sending email on other topics during the roadshow to people who were on the roadshow, correct?
To Jay, yes.
Let's put up Exhibit 268. So let's go down to the bottom of the document. So, Dr. Zarnik, by July 12th, 2000, the roadshow was underway, correct?
Yes.
And Jay and John and David Barker and Tim Kish, they were all out of the office on the roadshow, correct?
Yes.
On this date, July 12th, you were sending to Jay by email the binary coding work plan, correct?
Yes.
And so you were, at least on this topic, you were at least communicating with Jay while he was on the roadshow via email, correct?
I was trying, but Jay didn't respond to this email.
Okay, well, let's scroll down. Jay's assistant, Carmela, responded very quickly, correct? This message right here, the next day, or July 13th?
I need to see the date on the one at the bottom, please.
It's July 12th.
No, my email to Jay, so the next day, yes.
July 12th. So by the next day, you got a response from Carmela Haskell saying, Tony, due to the size of the email, Jay said he will not be able to open it up and respond until he's home. Do you see that?
Yeah, Jay could have sent that to me directly. I don't know why he didn't.
No, but wouldn't you agree with me that the content of Carmela's message to you basically told you that Jay had seen your email, but due to the size of the attachment, he wasn't going to be able to open it up and look at it until he was back?
Object. Calls for speculation.
It says Jay said he will not be able to open it. It appears Jay contacted Carmela.
After seeing your email?
Calls for speculation.
Could we see the bottom one again? I'm not sure if I saw it. Yes, I didn't CC Carmela, so I assume he did see it. Either that, or I don't know if Carmela was checking Jay's emails, I don't know.
But the verbiage of the response says, Jay said.
Yep.
And so you didn't email Jay Flatley, Mark Chi. You didn't email any of the people who were on the roadshow about your purported concerns about the 768 Decode experiment.
That's correct.
Now, on your direct examination, you say that within moments of learning about the dye problem, you went and addressed your concerns to Mark Chi verbally, correct?
Yes.
And on your direct exam, you stated that you asked Mark if he was aware that some of the dye had been mislabeled, and he said yes.
Yes.
And on your direct examination, you also testified that you specifically told Mark Chi that it was essential that he contact the roadshow team and tell them not to use the data because it could amount to fraud on the investors. Is that correct?
That's what I told Mark.
Okay. And you stated on direct that you specifically remember mentioning the concern to Mark about showing the data to investors?
Yes.
Now, you remember we discussed this topic when I deposed you last summer, correct?
Yes.
And I asked you in that deposition to tell me what you told Mark Chi after learning about the dye problem, correct?
Yes.
Going to read from your deposition beginning at page 190, which is in volume 2. 190, line 21. Did this give you concern when you learned that this reagent had been mislabeled by the supplier?
Yes.
What did you do? You say it was common knowledge at Illumina among the scientific staff by the time you heard it.
Yes.
What, if anything, did you do to communicate this to any of the executive management?
Before I started trying to get a refund, I confirmed with Mark he was aware of the problem.
How did you confirm that?
Verbally.
Was anyone else present when you did so?
No, the answer is no. No one else was present, and I urged Mark to tell Jay.
What was Mark's response?
I think there was no verbal response.
And then again at page 225, 225 line 8 through 227, 6. At what point in time did you express concerns about the experimental results of the 768 bead experiment?
To the best of my recollection, I talked with Mark within 2 days of my having been informed.
Then there's a break. We go off the record. Back on, the witness volunteers.
My answer to your question was specifically about when did I inform the company of my concerns regarding the mislabeling with the bad reagent. As I testified this morning, I had been raising concerns in the company literally for months about general methodology that was being used for decoding, and I had serious concerns whether the conclusion from those experiments could be supported.
I'm going to actually jump down to 226, line 10. Your learning of this bad reagent, as you previously testified, came about when Monica showed you the letter that the company had gotten from the supplier advising it of the mislabeling.
Yes.
And within 2 days of Monica showing you this letter from the supplier relating to the mislabeling, you informed the company of your concerns in what fashion? Verbally, email, written letter?
Verbally.
To whom did you direct those concerns?
To Mark.
Down to line 24. What do you remember saying to Mark?
I remember saying to Mark, did you know that the reagent was bad? And Mark said, yes. I said, you have to contact Jay and let him tell him that the experiment is flawed.
Did Mark make any response to that?
No.
Dr. Zarnik, during your deposition when I questioned you about this conversation that you were having with Mark Chi about the mislabeled dye, you didn't mention anything about having expressed concerns about fraud on investors, did you?
I'll object that the question is argumentative as framed. Just read a section of the testimony where she interrupted his answer, and she knows she never came back to this subject again. It's argumentative as phrased. She never asked him about the completion of the discussion.
Unless that's called for by a question, I think the objection should be sustained.
Okay, I'll ask a different question. Dr. Zarnik, I deposed you not for full days, but I deposed you over the course of 6 days last summer, correct?
Yes.
At no point during any of those 6 days did you testify under oath that you had made a comment expressing concern about fraud on investors?
Same objection. It's argumentative. He's here to answer her question. She never asked him that question. She never came back to it. It's argumentative.
Absent showing the court some question that would necessarily call for that in a response, the objection is sustained.
At no point during those 6 days of deposition did you volunteer such a statement, did you?
Objection, argumentative as phrased.
Sustained.
Your email to Mark Chi, let's put that up. The Code Blue email. Blow it up, please. This is Exhibit 332.
By the way, you also mischaracterized my deposition in another way.
I'm sure your counsel can take that up on your redirect. In this email sent September 5th, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you state, Mark, Jay was out when we learned that the Roadshow decode experiment was flawed. Is he now aware of the problem? When did you let him know? Dr. Zarnik, first of all, you see that you put Roadshow in quotes?
Not quotes, but they're the things that's a little bit less than a quote.
And the response from Mark Chi says, if the Roadshow decode experiment, as you call it, was flawed, that's a big surprise to me. What is it about Mark's response? You said earlier that you sent Mark Chi an email in which you characterized the experiment as the Roadshow experiment and that he agreed with you. What is it about his response here that causes you to believe that he's agreeing with your characterization?
Simply, he knew what experiment I was talking about.
Okay, but you will agree that the content of this makes it clear that he's not adopting the name that you've attached to it.
No, he doesn't say that. He just says he assumes that I'm referring to the 768 experiment.
Right. You see in the parenthetical, Roadshow decode experiment, as you call it. You see that?
Yes.
You don't say anything in your message about fraud on investors, do you?
No.
You never said anything about fraud on investors in written form until you filed your complaint in this lawsuit, correct?
In written form, I think that's correct.
Now, after the team returned from the roadshow, you expressed your concerns about the 768 decode results, didn't you?
What I did was to ask Jay if he had any problems with my getting a refund for the bad reagent. He was, you know, aware of the bad reagent, so we didn't discuss it any further.
Well, you drew a distinction between, in fact, it was in connection with this very email in your deposition. You just testified that you had a discussion with Jay in which you said that you wanted to try to obtain a refund for the bad dye because the reagent was bad, correct?
Yes.
You also testified in your deposition when I asked you why you were asking, let me strike that. In this email, you are asking Mark Chi whether Jay Flatley knows that, whether he is aware of the problem. When did you let him know?
Yes.
And in deposition, you drew a distinction between Mr. Flatley knowing a reagent was bad and Mr. Flatley having a conclusion that an experiment was flawed.
Objection to the form of the question, Judge.
Do you understand the question?
Yeah, I do.
You may answer.
Yes, they're not the same thing.
So the only communication that you had with Mr. Flatley was on the topic of the fact that the reagent was mislabeled. You didn't have a discussion with Mr. Flatley in which you said, Jay, I think that because the reagent was mislabeled, the experimental results are flawed.
Certainly. When Jay came back from the roadshow, the discussion that I had centered on the reagent.
Right. So let me just ask you a new question. Have you ever at any time had a conversation with Jay Flatley in which you stated in so many words, because the reagent was mislabeled, the experiment is flawed?
I believe that was in an email that was sent to Jay on the same day.
The day that you were fired?
Yes.
But shortly after the roadshow, let's set aside September 5th, but after the team returned from the roadshow at the very end of July, you didn't approach any of the people who had been on the roadshow and express to them a concern that investors might have been misled during the roadshow.
No, at that point I wasn't concerned about it because Mark had contacted the roadshow. Or at least I thought he had contacted the roadshow.
Well, my question was simply what you did. Not why, not the rationale or the basis for your actions or inactions, just what you did.
Argumentative.
So you did not approach any of the roadshow participants to express concerns, correct?
No.
Now I want to go back over a couple of different areas. You have characterized Dr. Stulpnagel's behavior toward you on April 6th as the worst moment of your entire life. Is that accurate?
I don't remember if I said that.
I'm going to read from Volume 6, page 909.
What page?
909.
Volume 6?
Volume 6. I'll read the question even though the statement doesn't have to do with the question. But question at line 17, question on page 908. So you were born with a tendency or a predisposition to depression?
Yeah, and up until the point that I started to experience it, I had a very good career and enjoyed life. After I started to experience it, life became harder to enjoy, and work was harder to accomplish as easily. But with time, you learn that the choices you have are either learn to deal with it and function, or give up and not function. And that's what I did. I function. And when I have days when it's a problem, I deal with it, either by just dealing with it or occasionally taking a day off and getting better. And I've been experiencing this disability for the last 10 years, and I've had ups and downs. I've actually had a hell of a good career in the last 10 years, in many respects better than the first 10 years of my career. The experience of being verbally attacked and humiliated in John's office was the single most difficult moment of my life to date. You asked me at one point if I was angry at John, and I am still so angry at John, I can just barely begin to describe it. The way the guy behaved toward me was inhuman, and took me from having had a bad depressive episode to being laid up. I've described to a number of people, a number of my docs, that it felt that day as though something broke in my head that is still broken. I wish I didn't have to describe that, because as somebody who is a scientist and dedicated to quantitative measure, you can't measure quantitatively what I'm feeling. It's not like describing pain on an index or a broken bone, but what I experienced that day in John's office as a result of his action was the single most intense moment of pain I ever experienced in my life. And frankly, of all the different reasons that I've been holding steady to bring this suit, that moment of barbarism is the reason I'm still here and looking you in the face and want to pursue this thing.
There's a couple more sentences if you want to be complete.
I think it ended.
It goes on.
Okay.
I was hurt and humiliated. My response to it was to be honest and explain what I was dealing with, and the response I got to that admission was to be cut out of the company that I helped to found. And I was angry every single day that I worked for Illumina.
Now, Dr. Zarnik, let me focus back on another occasion, May 18th. Let's have Exhibit 222, please. This is the date on which you visited the DFEH and filed your administrative charge, correct?
Yes.
Isn't it true you already had a scheduled meeting to meet with Jay Flatley and discuss goals?
I had a meeting with Jay. I didn't know what we were going to be discussing.
So you're denying that you understood that that meeting was for the purpose of giving you your goals?
Yes, I had no pre-information about that.
Okay. So focusing on... Let's scroll down. I need the one where he says he's going to be late. Probably immediately precedes this one. I'll come back to this once we have the exhibit. Now, isn't it true, Dr. Zarnik, that you were given goals on May 19th, correct?
Yes.
And isn't it true that it took you 3 months before you ever told Jay Flatley that you thought the goals were unreasonable?
No. The day after, I informed Jay that we didn't have the right tools for the new goal.
My question was, didn't it take you 3 months before you told Jay Flatley that you thought the goals were unreasonable?
No. I told him the next day we didn't have the equipment needed to do that experiment.
Okay, I'm going to read from your deposition, page 818, line 22. Did you ever tell Jay that you felt the goals were unreasonable?
No.
Is that true as to all the goals?
And I have to modify that. I did not tell him at this meeting that they were unreasonable. At a later point, I believe in August, I pointed out to him that they were unreasonable.
I'm sorry.
And that's after you were already being advised you weren't meeting these goals, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
I'll object to the line of questioning. It's argumentative.
It's direct impeachment, Your Honor.
If I could state my objection... In that, as Ms. Kearns knows, subsequent to the depositions, we've had tons of emails. It's intentionally misleading and argumentative.
It's what he testified to in his deposition, so the objection is overruled.
Now let's focus on Exhibit 222. This is an email from you to Jay Flatley, dated May 17th, and you are advising Jay Flatley that you are going the following day to the DFEH, correct?
Yes.
And you reference a scheduled meeting that is the next day, correct?
Yes.
And you state, at our meeting, I'd like to discuss your thoughts on the research fellow job description I wrote for David, my goals, and an update on my work. That was your language, correct?
Yes.
Now let's go to the next portion of the same exhibit. In fact, your meeting did run over, correct?
Yes.
And so you didn't make it back to Illumina that day, right?
I think I made it back, but it was something like 6 o'clock or 6:30.
You and Jay Flatley did not meet that day, correct?
That's correct.
Now, you got a message from Jay Flatley saying, since you couldn't make our meeting, he asks for some information, and you responded on Friday, and you represented to Jay Flatley that your appointment did run over, right?
Yes.
And you state in this email there were no public phones or water fountains in the building, correct?
I stated that. That was my understanding at the day I wrote it.
In fact, that was not accurate. Is that true?
I learned the next time I went back to the DFEH that there were phones there.
Did you carry a cell phone at the time, Dr. Zarnik?
No.
You didn't have a cell phone assigned to you by Illumina?
No.
So isn't it accurate to say that this representation, when you say there were no public phones, you made that statement as a means of explaining to Jay Flatley why you hadn't phoned him, right?
Yes.
And in fact, you didn't make any search for a public phone, did you?
I didn't make a search because when you go to the DFEH to make a complaint, you're put together in a room where they show you videotapes on what the complaint process is, etc. And they said don't leave the room.
And in fact, let me read from your deposition on that very point. Page 803, line 15. So you understood while you were at the DFEH that Jay Flatley was back at Illumina, and if you could make it by the 4 o'clock meeting, he was planning to meet with you.
And I told him the day before that if it ran over, then I would miss it.
Line 15 of page 803. As you were running late at DFEH, did you make any attempt to find a public phone?
No, I did not.
Why not?
Because we were told not to leave the room unless we had to use the bathroom.
And is that the only reason that you didn't try to find a phone to call Jay and let him know you'd be late?
Well, they were very specific about not leaving, so I simply followed their instructions.
Well, they told you you could leave the room to leave the bathroom. I think it was mistransposed, to use the bathroom, correct?
Yes.
Did you consider leaving the room ostensibly to use the bathroom in order to place a short phone call to let Jay know you were delayed?
That wouldn't be honest. That's exactly what happened.
Dr. Zarnik, isn't it true that during the time that you were working under your individual goals, the work plan which you sent to Jay Flatley via email while he was on the roadshow was late?
Yeah, the final work plan was later than what I'd expected, yes, and what Jay expected.
In fact, you were given your goals May 19th, correct?
Yes.
You assumed that the goals didn't begin until June 1st, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And that's because you had some vacation scheduled at the end of May?
Yes.
But you didn't confirm that with Jay Flatley in any way, did you?
No.
You didn't talk to him about when the goals begin?
No.
You just assumed that they wouldn't start until you had finished your vacation, correct?
I assumed Jay wouldn't start my goals until I was back from vacation.
How long was your vacation in May of 2000?
I think it was a week.
So between the time you got the goals and returned from vacation, there was roughly a 2-week period there. So you felt that the goals wouldn't start until you got back from vacation?
It's a week and a half.
But you didn't confirm that with Jay Flatley, correct?
No.
But if the goals began June 1st, which is what you had in your mind, wouldn't your 30-day goals have been due then July 1st?
Yes.
And you didn't send Jay Flatley a written work plan relating to the experiments on July 1st, did you?
No, Jay was on vacation by then.
Isn't it true that you, among others at Illumina, received an email from Jay explaining that during the first week of July, when he was on vacation, he would be working out of his home?
It may be. I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Do you have any reason to dispute that Jay Flatley communicated to everyone in Illumina that he would be on vacation but working out of his home and accessible?
No, I just don't have any recollection of that.
In fact, you didn't have a work plan ready to send to him on July 1st, did you?
I put the majority of the work plan in his box on June 30th.
You did not send him the final work plan until July 12th, correct?
That's correct.
Isn't it true that by early June of 2000, while you were working on these goals, actually while you were still in, by either party's count, in the first month of the goals, isn't it true that during the first month of being under the goals, you were already working with a headhunter seeking a different employment position?
It's true. I was talking with a headhunter about a position in Boston, yes.
With a company called US Genomics?
Yes.
And isn't it true that in preparing the experimental work plans, which were goals assigned to you, you had agreed with me that you would normally, in doing a work plan, include things like risks, contingencies, things that can come up that can either cause a project to be delayed or cost more, correct?
Yes, that's often included as part of a work plan.
Didn't you tell me, well, isn't it true that you didn't include discussion of those points in your work plan for your goals because you said you knew you wouldn't be there to—
I don't recall what I said. The fact is both. I did know I wasn't going to be there to finish them, and the things that caused delays, like reagents getting shipped late, not arriving on time, were things that I couldn't have known when I wrote the work plan.
Let me have the—
Tony, why don't you put it up for her if she needs it?
Your Honor, may I approach the witness with these lab notebooks?
Yes.
Dr. Zarnik, I've just handed you the originals of three lab notebooks which were assigned to you during your employment at Illumina. I think you've had a chance to examine these before. Isn't it true that two of the three lab notebooks before you are absolutely empty?
Yes, that's true.
And?
I would like to add that I actually don't remember why I had two. One is numbered 6 and one is 8, but I had checked out one in the beginning when I was chief scientific officer, and I didn't actually do any experiments with my own hands as chief scientific officer, so that's why these are empty.
Well, let me ask you to look at the book in which there is writing.
Yes.
And this is the lab notebook that was assigned to you on July 21st, 2000?
Yes.
It's been marked as Exhibit 272. Isn't it true, Dr. Zarnik, that this lab notebook, Exhibit 272, reflects the work that you did from July 21st, 2000, through your date of termination?
Yes.
And can you thumb through the lab notebook and tell me how many pages of writing you generated in that period, July 21st through September 5th?
10 pages, with some pages covering multiple days.
And those 10 pages reflect the work you did from the period of July 21st through September 5th, 2000?
They are the comments that I made in response to work that I did.
Well, if you had done experiments, they would have been reflected in the lab notebook, correct?
Except for trivial experiments that are required sometimes to get to the point where you can do an interesting experiment.
If you had done any interesting experiment, they would have been reflected in the lab notebook?
That hurt.
For example, if you had done... One of your goals was to demonstrate proof of principle or feasibility of binary oligoencoding at a certain level. If you had actually done that experiment, you would have written it in your lab notebook, right?
Yes.
And one of your goals was to... Well, I guess a later goal was to do the same proof of principle or proof of concept experiment, but at a higher level of complexity. And if you had done that experiment, it would have been in the lab notebook?
Yes.
Did you understand, Doctor? Now, the binary oligoencoding goal, this was an idea or an invention of yours, right?
Yes.
And did you understand that in doing... We've heard from your counsel the fact that at that point in time, no one in the company had done any work on binary oligoencoding. Is that correct?
Yes.
Isn't it true that to do the binary oligoencoding experiment, you would have been able to use some of the building blocks or technology that had been developed in connection with the existing scientific work?
Well, we would have needed to develop new beads. They weren't in existence. But some of the DNA, for example, was available.
And you would have perhaps been able to use the same sort of attachment chemistry to attach the oligos to the beads?
Yes.
And the same kind of attachment chemistry to attach the beads to the wells?
Yes.
So you needed to develop different beads?
Yes.
But you will agree with me that in order to do the binary oligo encoding, there were a number of steps that would have been required in that experiment that had already been done at Illumina.
Yes.
Based on your estimate, counsel, you are out of time.
Okay. I think I'm done.
Your Honor, we agreed that I would do not only recross but rebuttal, one fell swoop, when I returned to Dr. Zarnik at the end of the case.
So he's done for today?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Next on our list was to use a videotaped excerpt of a witness. It's going to run considerably past 12 o'clock, so perhaps we could play part of it, break for lunch, and play the rest of it?
Yes.
This is the videotaped deposition of Richard Pytalewski.
It need not be reported by the reporter because you will provide a copy of
Yes, we have the written transcript.
Right.
Is that agreeable, counsel?
That's fine.
Okay. Is this a good place to stop?
Let's play the next excerpt because it's related.